You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. For a long time, my approach to meditation was that I couldn't do it. People would tell me I should meditate, and I would get very annoyed with them. When I would try to sit and do what I thought meditation was, I felt like it made everything worse. There were too many thoughts, and there was too much anxiety, and it didn't feel like it was going to go anywhere. The thing about anxiety is that it doesn't just go away when you try to avoid it. In fact, that usually makes it worse. At some point along the way, I realized that sitting with uncomfortable feelings, without distraction, is the only way to actually get through them. So now I meditate pretty regularly. I still don't really like doing it, and I'm not even sure if I'm doing it right, but I do it the way it works for me, and I always feel better when I do. In our first story, Ivana dives headfirst into meditation and finds herself struggling in the deep end.
If you've watched the episode of Fleabag, where Fleabag and her sister go on a silent retreat, you would not have seen it as an advertisement for silent retreats. The show certainly doesn't sell it to us. From stints of unpaid menial labour to woo-woo well-being exercises, and no Wi-Fi or entertainment whatsoever. And yet, the thought of living a radically different lifestyle for a while, enduring the challenge of being silent for a period while living with strangers, that was thoroughly interesting to me. So it was that I found my own silent retreat to go on last year. Sensing that it would be ripe for stories, I diarized my 7 days of noble silence, Vipassana teaching, and communal living. Day zero. Check-in. I'm waiting in a short line in a beautiful rustic building. This is the dining hall, where I'll later have breakfast, lunch and dinner for the next 7 days, alongside my group of 30-odd to be spiritually enlightened people. By the kitchen is the water cooler. Submerged in the water is what looks to be activated charcoal. Of course. In mason jars to my right is an impressive selection of teas. Next to the coffee is a box of herbal laxative tea. There's a handwritten note taped to it that reads, "Please use if needed." It's punctuated with a love heart. It's late in the afternoon when we check in. We settle into our sleeping quarters, have dinner, then meet in the meditation hall for our first sitting meditation. It's my very first time doing meditation in any kind of sustained way. Despite my discomfort, I find myself nodding off. I suspect this won't be a rarity. Day one. The morning begins at 5:45 with someone walking by our cottages, gently ringing a bell. 6 a.m. is an optional yoga class or self-led exercise, or a sleep-in, should one choose, until the 45-minute sitting meditation session at 6:45. In my first ever yoga class, we're asked to name our intention for the day. Mine: don't be late for yoga tomorrow. When you're late for yoga, you're rewarded with a spot that nobody else wants, directly in front of the teacher and in front of the whole class. Morning meditation was kind of nice. The hall had yet to achieve maximum natural brightness. Birds chirp, but otherwise there is a calming stillness and quiet. Since yesterday, I'd gone from sitting cross-legged on the flat cushion I'd brought with me to straddling a log-like cushion on top of my flat one. I have a plan to add a new accoutrement to my pile every day and see if anyone notices. Each day will follow the same schedule. We have 5 sessions of sitting meditation, 4 sessions of walking meditation, and a reclining meditation session at night. An hour of mindful work, essentially helping with chores to offset the cost of our retreat. 3 meals, and all of it in silence. That is, apart from the 2 daily sessions. One is inquiry, where we can sit at the front of the class next to one of the teachers and receive their wisdom on an experience we've had at the retreat or a problem from our life that most likely inspired our attendance at the retreat. The other session is the evening Dharma talk, when we get schooled in the Vipassana tradition of Buddhism. Reclining meditation is the moonlit handoff to bedtime. It's my favourite of the meditation sessions. It's basically napping. We get to lie down and contemplate the lazily turning ceiling fan. Tonight, we listen to some music. Day 2. I have meditation accoutrement envy over another woman's setup. My back and ankles have been killing me, whereas she seems nice and comfy, lying on her mini foam floor chair with bent legs, knees pointed skywards. In the inquiry session today, that woman spoke quietly about her best friend. Her best friend is critically ill in hospital, and she doesn't know if she's going to make it. She wiped away some tears as she shared this. Then she straightened up and smiled brightly. She told us that during walking meditation earlier in the day, she managed to develop unconditional love for everything, even the dead leaves and bird poo. Somehow, through this insight, she managed to let go of her best friend. She said she'll always have her love for her best friend to stay connected with her. Even though she seems to have found some sort of inner peace, I go up to her at dinner anyway and give her a hug, and she flashes me that bright smile of hers. Day 3. So far, we've been taught the four noble truths in Buddhism. Firstly, the existence of dukkha, or suffering. Second, that the suffering is caused by clinging and attachment, wanting things or the absence of something, holding on to memories, circumstances, people. The third noble truth is that to cease our suffering, we have to cease our clinging and attachment. And the fourth affirms that this is how to end dukkha. Adjacent to the four noble truths, we're taught impermanence. Nothing lasts, nothing stays the same. Life, people, everything around us comes and goes. We need to acknowledge this, and the better we get at simply noticing the things around us without forming attachment to them, the less we will suffer. We're taught this, but I can't believe in it. I am all about wanting, striving, and working hard to fulfill my ambitions. I believe in investing deeply and emotionally, accepting as part of the bargain that the things I love most have the potential to hurt me the greatest. This is the cost I accept of living the way that I do. And I can't imagine, nor understand the value of, keeping everything and everyone at arm's length. At least, that's how I interpret the teachings. In the meditation hall, I am still. Okay, not perfectly still, I am easily the most restless of everyone in the group. I am sort of still on the outside, but on the inside, my mind is beginning to rebel. Day 4. It's safe to say that life at the retreat has been a major adjustment. I've gone from not doing any meditation to meditating most of the day, from living alone to sharing a room with someone, from relative autonomy to living by a schedule prescriptive to the last 15 minutes, from checking my phone constantly to being completely offline. Then there's the not talking. Noble silence. In meditation, the mental rebellion continues. It's not just about the teachings, but taming my monkey mind. We've been given mantras each day to focus on and contemplate, scaffolding to lean on while we're still practicing. The scaffolding, however, isn't working for me. I can't simply breathe in, liberating the heart and mind, and breathe out, liberating the heart and mind, for 45 minutes. At least, not without dozing off. So I've been letting my mind wander, and a place it has tended to go to is one that keeps me, shall we say, stimulated. I've been thinking many impure thoughts about the boyfriend back home and making a to-do list. The other thing I've been doing is expanding my Russian vocabulary. When I'm back in my cottage, I look up in offline Google Translate the Russian words for all the things I can see in the meditation hall, and then I practice them during sitting meditation. Teacher?
Учитель.
Walls.
Стены.
Ceiling.
Потолок.
I've even translated some key words from the teachings. Freedom.
Свобода.
Suffering.
Страдание.
My Russian учитель would be so proud. So that's where I'm up to. And in case you were wondering, I've now acquired 3 cushions and a blanket for my meditation setup. I have my eye on a wooden floor chair, essentially a legless chair, but I'm not sure it's within my grasp. Day 5. I came to this retreat expecting to have my boundaries challenged and indeed relished the prospect of testing my mental limits. Today, though, freaked me out. And perhaps all the more so because no one else seemed to find what happened and what's been happening unusual or perturbing. In the inquiry session today, I noticed that each of the people who got up and spoke had become steeped in the language of our teachers. That vocabulary, conditioning, clinging, suffering. The environment felt suddenly cult-like, and everyone seemed to be in on it but me. Those same people also shared the incredible insights they'd had over the retreat. Insight, by the way, is another example of the terminology, because this is, after all, Vipassana, or insight meditation. One guy, around my age, had shared at an earlier inquiry session about an ex he'd struggled to let go of. Their breakup from years ago echoed in his mind, and he doubted his ability to ever love another as he loved her. In today's inquiry, however, he demonstrated that he'd turned a major corner. He realized through meditation that he doesn't need to cling to suffering, that there is no self, and that the I props itself up through suffering. The teacher responded that,
"When we see the cessation of the I, suffering ends."
One woman, in her early 60s, spoke of a traumatic childhood incident that left her with guilt whenever she was happy. She spent the past 6 decades feeling like there is nothing to be happy about. This week, though, she realised that she does deserve to be happy. From now on, she'll live life with a whole new perspective on the world. She practically glowed. When I left that session, I felt like I'd been punched in the gut. My fellow students were drinking the Kool-Aid, getting sucked in. And I was the only emotionally stable person, the only one who didn't need any saving, who could see what was going on around here. Being the outsider, though, has a way of making you question your beliefs. It makes you uncertain about whether the problem is with everyone else or whether it's actually with you. So then I had to wonder, why was I so resistant to the teachings? Why wasn't I having deep insights? What was wrong with me? I'm not very proud to admit this, but I broke my online detox. I went onto Messenger and basically sent an SOS to my best friend. Fortunately, he was able to respond in real time, and spending just a few minutes connecting to someone I'm close to from my real life helped to ground me again. At that point, I decided that while I wasn't going to engage in my pre-retreat daily traffic of emails and messages, I was going to do little things online, such as identifying the best places to eat and drink in this town for after the retreat, to keep myself sane. Also, I regret to inform you that I skipped this evening's sitting and reclining meditations and Dharma talk. Instead, I curled up with a copy of Sally Rooney's Normal People, which I borrowed off another student. That is all. Day 6. This morning, I found a tick buried in my shoulder, and I panicked. I tried to pull it out with my tweezers, but some of the tick remained under my skin. I got all worried about Lyme disease and developing a meat allergy, so I broke noble silence and verbalised my panic to my roommate. My roommate assured me I had nothing to worry about and showed me her abbed stomach, which had a coin-sized rash on it. She said she'd spoken to the gardener, who'd said the ticks around here don't carry disease. I felt a bit calmer after that. I must say that I'm getting excited about being done with the retreat tomorrow. There are so many things I'm looking forward to doing once I have my freedom again. Or my svoboda. For example, music. On that front at least, I've been respecting the spirit of the retreat and have refrained from listening to music, podcasts, and watching any kind of video content. I've been feeling the deprivation and have given a lot of thought to what the first song will be that I'll listen to when I'm out of here. And I've decided that my first song in 7 days will be It's Late by Queen. It's not something I often listen to, but it's galvanizing and moving and all those good things. And I'm craving that kind of intensity of emotion.
You say you love me, and I hardly know your name.
At Inquiry today, the retreat manager shared a philosophical dilemma from her normal life with the teacher and with us. She didn't know how to feel about a person who is a total jerk but does a lot of good professionally. After inquiry, I went up to her and said in sotto voce that I was really intrigued by what she'd said. I offered my opinion on the matter and we had an energetic, hushed discussion in the garden. Ultimately, I felt like we agreed that it doesn't matter to the people the jerk is helping that he's a terrible person. That conversation was the most uplifting moment of connection I'd had all week, and it involved another act of rebellion, breaking Noble's silence in a big way by talking so much in such a compressed time period. I'm inclined to think of this as another clear example of how the tenets of this retreat don't agree with me. The day after day 7. On our last day of the retreat, during reclining meditation, there was an unexpected delight. Rather than the usual traditional tunes, our teacher played Leonard Cohen's Dance Me to the End of Love.
Dance me to the end of love.
My heart felt so full. Our last day was more of a half day, ending in the early afternoon. Although, if you consider that our days began at 5:45 in the morning, it was basically 3/4 of a day. Yes, I was counting. The day did not follow our regular schedule. Instead of our mindful work period, we packed up our things and gathered our bed linen. And instead of the second walking meditation session before lunch, we were to participate in a closing activity to mark the official end of Noble Silence. What that involved was sitting in a circle in the meditation hall and each taking a turn to say something about our experience at the retreat. We spoke in random order. Most people thanked their fellow students, the teacher, the manager, and praised the cook's cooking to high heaven. A couple of people had the tissue box passed around to them and they demurely dabbed at their eyes. As people spoke, I mentally planned what I was going to say. I was going to joke around, but also be earnest. I'd confess that I'd been a terrible student, more restless than everyone else, monkey mind, Russian vocab, that I'd had trouble accepting the teachings, all of it. All except the impure thoughts, that I'd keep to myself. And I'd add that I had nevertheless had a valuable experience, met lots of nice people and was thankful, yada yada. The number of people left to speak dwindled. For some reason, I found myself increasingly anxious. Then the teacher's gaze turned to me. My throat constricted and, to my complete and utter surprise, I burst into tears. Through choked sobs, I managed to get out some of what I'd rehearsed, but obviously it didn't have the same effect. I could not understand why I was so emotional. Not then. In processing it later, though, I realised that in spite of everything I'd actively disliked about the retreat, that I'd diarised in great, quippy detail, I was actually really sorry to be leaving. Despite my complaints, to myself, I should add, I had fundamentally adapted to life at the retreat. There was something comforting about avoiding real life for a solid chunk of time, about the routine, all that nothingness, and being guided moment to moment. It felt jarring to have to face the outside world again, for all its attendant stresses, joys, and responsibilities. Most of all, though, I realized I'd missed the people at the retreat and how nurturing, supportive, and kind they'd all been. And how I'd taken for granted the truly special environment this created. At the retreat, there had been no scorn, no politics, no indifference. People had shared during inquiry their deepest traumas, and their vulnerability was met with compassion and warmth. These were the people I'd sat next to for endless silent hours of meditation and three meals a day. We smiled to each other while walking wordlessly past and formed a camaraderie washing dishes side by side. And I was never going to see them again. But as I mentioned, sitting in that circle, it had not yet dawned on me why I was crying. I finished choke talking and the teacher wrapped things up shortly thereafter. The circle broke and some of my fellow, now enlightened attendees, swarmed me, offering hugs and words of assurance. The people included the retreat manager, as well as a retired gent who had professed his love of spreadsheets to the class. He looked at me solemnly and said, "Your heart is finally cracking open."
That story was produced by Ivana Ho. Ryan Pemberton was the supervising producer. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you should come along to one of our pitch workshops. You'll learn all about how stories for the show get made and how to craft your pitch. The workshops are happening on the 17th of March at FBI Radio in Sydney and SYN in Melbourne. You can find all of the info at allthebestradio.com. Sara Mir grew up in Tehran during the Iran-Iraq War. When her neighbourhood was hit by an airstrike, her family picked up their roots to find a safer place to live.
So it's called the safest place. Tehran 1985 is a normal day. I'm playing with my dolls as my mom prays. Attention, attention. What you hear now is the red alert for an air attack. Leave your place of work and go into a safer shelter as soon as possible. But mom didn't hear the warning. I could see my mom flying toward me. I saw glass flying through the air. "It might be a chemical bomb," she said. We rushed downstairs. She threw me under the shower with all my clothes on. She desperately shouted for my sisters to come down. Then she ran upstairs. That's when I noticed there was blood on my feet. And hands, As mom went upstairs, she left some puddles of water on the floor, which caused my sister to slip on her way down. Oh, mom was frantic. Then she screamed, "Oh no, your brother is outside. All of you, stay in the shower." I thought it was funny that my sister had slipped over. We played in the water. We were too young to care. Later, we heard a noise upstairs. It was our dad. He told us about our brother. He was riding to the bakery to get some bread. The bomb knocked him over. At night, the whole family and our neighbor come down into the basement. My brother's hand was broken. I slept under the stairs on a shoe rack. Our neighbor's house was totally destroyed. Everyone went to see the ruins. My mom hosted our traumatized neighbors in our basement. After a few weeks, she became overwhelmed and depressed. My dad and my sister used to go onto our roof to watch the air raids. Then mom decided we would leave Tehran to Kashmir, which is a city located away from the bomb in the eastern part of Iran. It was a long, long trip through valleys and over mountains to Kashmir. It's so green and peaceful. An old city lost in the desert, with simple mud house homes and ancient monuments. Kashmir is half modern and half mud brick. And we loved it. It's a different world. As I grew up, and when the stress of modern life became too much, I still sought refuge in Kashmir. Many years have passed, and I left Iran some time ago. When Trump talks about war with Iran, I sympathize with my mom, and I start to feel anxious. When I talk to mom, I tell her she might be safer in Kashmir. But my sister takes out her frustration on me. She's angry about everything: US sanctions, shitty government, the economy, poverty, and threats of war. I agree with her. Everyone needs a place to feel safe.
That was Sara Mir reading her comic, The Safest Place, with sound design and original composition by Alina Godwin. It was recorded at Read to Me, a live storytelling night in Sydney. Sara is one of the organisers of the Refugee Art Project, which runs art workshops for refugees and asylum seekers at the Villawood Detention Centre. You can find out more about the Refugee Art Project by visiting their Facebook page. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Alina Godwin. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best community coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN community coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find all of our episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe.